2FM with Green Farm. Fuel your day with Green Farm's new high-protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Thanks to Jenny Green for entertaining us this afternoon. It's Wednesday the 6th of October and this is Game On. Coming up today, it is what it is, or is it? We hear from the PFAI as Callum Robinson turns the spotlight on vaccination amongst professional footballers.
I think it's your personal choice if you want to be vaccinated. I haven't been vaccinated yet, no. That's my choice at this moment in time.
Lisa Fallon and Jeff Shepherd will bring us up to speed on the sexual misconduct scandal that has rocked women's football in the US and globally.
It is the whole spectrum of emotions, completely overwhelmed. The support and the validation by everyone globally has just been, it has blown me away.
Plus, we've Craig Breen on his major new drive in the WRC, and we'll hear from the Camogie Club who've made local success international.
Game on 2FM.
If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM. Now we are going to get straight into it. The story dominating the headlines today is that Republic of Ireland international Callum Robinson has revealed that he is yet to take a COVID-19 vaccine. Robinson told a press conference earlier that he has decided not to take the vaccine in spite of the fact that he has contracted the virus twice. There are a number of Irish players who have not taken the vaccine. The FAI then moved to issue a statement following Robinson's revelations that he's not vaccinated, saying it accepts the right of all individuals. I am joined on the line now by PFAI General Secretary Stephen McGuinness. Stephen, it's been a very interesting day in the world of vaccinations and professional sports, with Callum Robinson definitely starting a conversation, and an important conversation as well, just going by the reaction to it. What is the stance of the PFAI when it comes to football players and the vaccination?
I suppose, Marie, from our point of view, it has been our instruction to the players that we would encourage players to get the vaccination. So I know Stuart spoke earlier on with Claire Bourne and said the same. And I suppose it's up to each individual to make that decision. But from a players' union perspective, we're taking guidance, obviously, from the health experts. And I suppose when it comes down to it, that it is down to each individual whether they take the vaccine or not. Now, we've spoken to a number of clubs in our own league who were looking for the rights and wrongs of whether they could ask the players whether they've been vaccinated or not. And we didn't have an issue with the clubs asking the players, but there's nothing contractually that obliges the players to either tell the club or get vaccinated. So, again, it's an individual choice. Callum Robinson articulated it yesterday. And when you listen to the Irish international manager, Stephen Kenny, it was his opinion that every player should be vaccinated.
Yeah, and look, he didn't give exact numbers, but when he was asked if it was in single figures or above 10, this is Stephen Kenny, he said, I don't have exact figures, but it wouldn't be too many more than that. And this kind of sits alongside the average of the Premier League teams, where 13 of the 20 clubs in the top division of English football have squads where fewer than 50% of the players are vaccinated. Do you know what the figures are like in this country when it comes to the footballers?
Yeah, no, it's not something that we've had. We've obviously discussed it with our player delegates and our player reps at the clubs. Obviously, getting into the dressing rooms to meet the players, it's not possible to do that at the moment. But we have anecdotally heard of players who haven't been vaccinated in our league. I don't think it's anywhere near them numbers. And again, that's again speculation in the UK that that's the number, because nobody's done any sort of survey with the players around in England to get that. So that's completely, I'm not saying it's fabricated, but it's definitely a figure that's out there that I don't know where it's coming from. It hasn't. Like in society in general, I just don't like to see people point the fingers at football and saying they're not being vaccinated, or they don't care about their bodies. They do. It's some of the stuff that's come out today, I'm not sure how accurate that information is. I do see an element, though, with elite athletes feeling that maybe they are fit enough or strong enough to get through if they contracted the virus. Now, in our opinion, that's a dangerous thing to do when you don't know how it's going to affect you. That's why we would encourage people to take the vaccine. But again, athletes, some are choosing not to do it, and that's completely up to themselves. But again, the figures just today, I just wonder where them figures are coming from. And in our own league, I don't think the figures are anywhere next to there. That I do, from my understanding of the players I've spoken to, everybody has been vaccinated. There has been some clubs who've been in contact and asked for some clarity around that, what our position was. So we've been clear that we'd advise our members to be vaccinated, double vaccinated.
I know Stephen Bradley was asked about it last week and he said they never put any pressure to get on anyone to get the vaccine, but thankfully the players were really mature and responsible about it, and they all went and got it, which is fantastic. It means we can all relax a little bit around each other. Just on some of the facts that you mentioned there, and one of them that seems to come up quite often is just the fact that a lot of players feel, because they are professional athletes, that they, you know, that they'd be able to cope with whatever comes their way because they are so fit. But a lot of the medical experts have said, because they are training at such a high level and pushing themselves just to the limit, that often that their immune systems aren't as strong as maybe somebody that isn't pushing their body to the limit. Do you think that there's a lot of misinformation out there, that some of these footballers are living in a bubble where they're maybe not getting the education on the vaccine that they need to make a more informed decision?
Yeah, I think there's an element of that in every piece of society, not just professional footballers. I think there's an element of, I see some stuff floating around saying that around, you know, from pregnant women, whether, you know, the fertility and all that can be an issue. So there is lots of stuff out there that when you spend a bit of time and spend a bit of time reading up on the vaccine and reading up on what it does and doesn't do, like, there's been billions of these vaccines being given all around the world, and so far it looks safe. We don't know the long term, but in the short term it looks safe. So I do think there is a lot of misinformation that is out there. I do think there's an element, and you can't get away from this, of players feeling that there is a bit of invincibility about them, and that goes for all people who are in sport. There is that feeling, and that's something that from our perspective, and I know from Stephen Kenny, who spoke yesterday, that we are encouraging people to get vaccinated, and that you are not invincible, that you are prone, like everybody else, to the real fear of COVID-19 and long COVID, which again, we don't know what the effects are. So again, as I said, we would be encouraging people to get the vaccine, but it's their choice.
It's interesting just hearing the different managers' reaction to it. Stephen Kenny did come out and speak a little bit about it. He's getting criticised for maybe not being more forceful about it, and that's probably coming after people listened to Jurgen Klopp and how forceful he was about it, and said it's similar to drink driving and it endangers other people. But then on the opposite spectrum was Thomas Tuchel, who just said, look, it's up to their players, whatever they want to do, that he's not going to make any recommendations about the vaccinations. What do you think is the right thing to do for these managers who do have influence over their players?
Yeah, I suppose, like everything, Marie, everybody's under contract currently. Now, we may foresee down the line that clubs may look for players to prove to them that they have been vaccinated before they sign them. That might be something that will come down the line. Currently, under contract, the contracts that we have in Ireland, there's no caveat in there in regards to pandemics or in regards to vaccinations. But it's something that potentially down the line clubs may look for that information ahead of signing the player. So they may feel that if a player isn't vaccinated that they don't want to sign him. That's something that clubs will have to decide on. But again, each manager, as you rightly said, has taken a different position. And some have been fairly forceful on it and demanding that the players get vaccinated. Others, as you said, have a more relaxed approach. Again, it's down to every individual player. But contractually right now, there's not much the clubs can do to force the players to do it. But long term, you may have a situation where clubs may look for clauses in the contract that allows them to ask the question and then to get the answer. And if you don't have it, it may well be that contractually that they would look. Now, there's discrimination issues around that and everything else, but that potentially is something that might come down the line.
There's also a school of thought out there as well, Stephen, that it'll be the players themselves that end up policing it, that we might get to a stage where certain elements in the dressing room decide that they're not comfortable being in a dressing room with unvaccinated players, or they're not comfortable playing against players who are unvaccinated, just because they want to protect those around them, and there's a social responsibility there as well. Have you been contacted by any players who might feel concerned that they're sharing dressing rooms with players who have decided not to get vaccinated?
No, it's not a worry. I have been contacted with some managers who are aware that some of the players in the group hadn't been vaccinated and had asked for their assistance in regards to getting the message out there that it's important that they get vaccinated. Now, we have done that, but I'm not contacting players individually. I don't think it's right to contact players individually to tell them to get vaccinated. That's their choice. The decisions that the club make on the makeup of their squad and the makeup of the background of the players, that's up to the club to decide on that. there will be individual players, I'm sure, that will look at it and say, I'd rather, if all my teammates were vaccinated. But again, that's each individual player's choice. And again, it's the club's decision on who they sign and who they don't sign. So, as I said already, I do think it's something that potentially down the line you may see in contracts where they will ask the question. And then it's up to the club then we're going to sign them or not. But again, like everything, the better players, like if Cristiano Ronaldo isn't vaccinated, are we going to say to Manchester United, they're going to sign him? Of course they are, because he's the best player. So sometimes this stuff, depending on who it is, again, dictates how people's perception are around it. So again, in the UK, I think it's been slightly different, because the UK opened up so early that I just don't know whether the drive was there, like in Ireland, where we couldn't do a hell of a lot of things unless we got vaccinated. I looked at the UK, saw they opened up pretty early, and whether the vaccine was actually really required by the players over there. And I just don't know whether they took a more laxed approach than maybe our own players did on it. And that's just me looking at it from the outside, because the feeling that I have within our own league is that the majority of players have been vaccinated.
It's interesting to see now the situation that the Premier League are in because of the low vaccination rates, and they're considering whether they need to reward the clubs with high rates of players vaccinated against coronavirus, which would probably make you worry about how little of the players really are vaccinated. Do you ever think, or do you think that that might be something that could come into play here?
I suppose when you look at, I suppose the one thing is when you're looking at how many players are missing games in England, they seem to have it in control in the clubs. I did see in Germany where one club have basically turned around to the players who weren't vaccinated and got them to pay for the vaccinations themselves, which was costing roughly €2,000 a year to get the testing. So they would have to pay for the testing themselves if they didn't get vaccinated. So that's what one German club has done. The Premier League, obviously, on a bigger scale, you don't see the amount of people missing games or players missing with COVID-19 right now. So unless there was a spate of it in the Premier League, I don't know whether you're going to see any changes there. But it seems to be well controlled in the club environment, and the players are obviously looking after themselves outside, because we don't seem to have a major clampdown on games now where a number of players at a Premier League club have got the virus. There is one or two, but not in the scale that would make you think, look, there needs to be something drastically done here.
Yeah, the contract thing that you mentioned a little bit earlier is interesting, and I know we've seen in the NFL with certain managers not getting vaccinated and losing their contracts and then making U-turns because they don't really have a choice if they want to work. But managers like Stephen Kenny, they can choose really to pick players who are vaccinated, and just given the fact that everything that has happened during his reign as manager with COVID knocking out so many of his players, and just the fact that he's trying to keep his squad in a bubble, I guess that if that did happen, it wouldn't be a huge surprise.
No, well, that's Stephen's individual choice. Like, he's picked Callum Robinson, who's missed a number of games, obviously, with COVID, and he's still decided to pick him, which is his prerogative, and he's fine to do so. So I suppose, as you said, that's down to each individual manager. It's down to each individual club, how it manages the club and how it runs this club and the players that it signs. So at the end of this season, our club's majority of players in our league, as you well know, Marie, are out of contract at the end of the season. So the clubs have a decision to make when they go and sign players next year. They may well ask the question when they're signing the players, have you been vaccinated or have you not? And then make a decision on the back of that. So these are discussions I think that will happen in the off-season. Now, at this moment in time, as I said to you, I don't see a problem here. We are aware of some players, but it's not the problem that seems to be in the UK. And as it just caveat to that is, again, all that stuff is just... there's no survey, nobody's done any studies on this in the UK in regards to the players. So the numbers coming out are from 30 to 50%. Like, nobody seems to know exactly what the figures are. And the other thing as well is nobody seems to know the reasons why the players aren't getting vaccinated. But we still don't seem to understand yet what the reasons are. So are they cultural reasons? What are the reasons why players won't get it? And then, as you said, the education piece behind it needs to come in to ensure that players feel it comfortable. And maybe that piece of it hasn't been done quite as well in the UK as it is here.
It will be interesting for you guys as well, Stephen, if it gets to the stage where it becomes a bone of contention for contracts too, because the players no doubt will be leaning on ye for advice, which means you'll probably be forced to take a stance then.
I mean, it depends, obviously, from a contractual point of view. Do the clubs look for a clause in the contract? The standard players contract is currently there's no clause in it, so that would have to be something that would be agreed with us and the clubs if they were going to put any sort of clause in it around the pandemic or around the current situation. There's been no discussions around that at the moment, so until that becomes a reality, then we'll deal with it then when it comes in. But I suppose that's something we just have to wait and see.
Yeah, and contract season is just around the corner. Look, it has been an interesting day just in terms of all of the discourse around Callum Robinson and his decision, and the fact as well that there's so many people who have been affected by COVID over the last few months, and they see people like Callum Robinson as role models and would probably like to see more of the people that they're looking up to vaccinated. But look, Stephen, let's park that for a minute, because you yourself have been fighting a very tough battle over the last few months. You are now, from what I gather, recovering from cancer, and I can't even imagine how difficult it's been for you over the last few months.
Yeah, no, it has been. It's been tough, and I suppose there's an element, Marie, a bit like the COVID situation, where players really feel invincible. I think former athletes and former players like myself feel that you're a bit invincible as well, and that you don't need to go and get tested, and you don't act on signs, and that's something that I did. I didn't react to certain things that were changing in my life, and from fatigue, from passing of blood, from different things that had happened over the last year, I didn't react to them. And I think I do put that down to representing professional athletes, being a former player myself, thinking that I'm a bit invincible here. And I pawed off the warning signs and didn't react to them. And one of the learning curves from my end is that I should have been getting blood tests every year, Marie. I should have been going to the doctor when there was warning signs there, and I didn't. And unfortunately, that meant that the cancer had grown from my large intestine into my stomach. And the operation, which would have been a keyhole surgery to extract it from the large intestine, ended up being a massive operation, with them having to take away 3/4 in the stomach as well as the large intestine, and a lot longer recovery than what it should have been.
So what's the timeline then, like from when you got your diagnosis to today?
Yeah, so I was diagnosed on February 1st, operating on February the 15th, and so we're about 8 months now past it. And the one side of it, Marie, from my own perspective, was the physical side of it wasn't something that I was able to deal with. The physical side, it was the mental side that I really, really struggled with. I think there's a lot of people who have got cancer, and people talk about the physical scars and how people have to deal with it, but the mental scars are far more deep-rooted and far more difficult to deal with, I believe. And the amount of people after I done a piece at the start of the weekend have been in touch to say that they were in a similar position, and start to look at my own things, and yeah, people need to talk more about the mental side of dealing with it rather than just the physical side, which just tends to be what people focus on. So people ask you the questions normally, do you have pins and needles in your hands or your feet, or and how is the wound, is it recovering, and this, that, and how are you eating? But the real problems I had was in my head. Mentally, I couldn't deal with what had happened, and I couldn't deal with day-to-day stuff. I just couldn't deal with it. And I was just very lucky to have good infrastructure around with my friends and family that to get through that. But it needed a huge amount of work from. I got some help from Mark, who's the group that's involved with the Mater Hospital, to talk about my mental health. And that's something that I'd never struggled with. I always felt I was mentally very, very strong. But this disease really opened me up to understanding better how some of my own members suffer with mental health. And maybe, as I said, the players have contacted me, and I used to look at them and go, how has he got mental health? He's just the top of the league. He's a top young player in the country. He's getting very lots of money. How can he be dealing with an issue with mental health? Until I found myself in that position. And I really, really struggled with that. I couldn't move out. I didn't move out of the house for 2 months. I wouldn't talk to anybody. I didn't want anybody to see me. I'd lost 25 pounds of weight. I looked like a skeleton. I just didn't want to see anybody. I was living from sleeping tablet to sleeping tablet. All I wanted to do was sleep and just get through each day and just hope that I would get better. And I was lucky, as I said, by friends that I had through football who called up to the house and just refused to leave the garden and leave the house until I came out and spoke to them. And they gave me that little bit of a leg up and said, look, you don't look too bad. You'll be fine. Like, just keep talking. And that's one thing that we don't do. And I look at my own wife and other people I know who on the first sign of anything are straight into the doctors and get checked and get regular blood tests and friends of mine who would do it. But just from my end, and I know a lot of players I played with and I've spoken to a lot of them over the last couple of days who now are going to get blood tests on the back of what happened to me, which is a positive, and if there's obviously the negative on what I went through, but if that can help one, two people, well then that's great. And it's one thing that when I go around the dressing rooms and we speak to the players, it's to ensure that they do act on anything medically that they see, and any change in their body or any change in how they deal with stuff during the day, they need to make sure that they get checked. And that's something that hopefully is a positive that comes out of my situation.
It sounds like you learned more about yourself in those 8 months than you did maybe in your whole professional football career.
I 100% did, and I do think, as I said already, I do think there's this thing about professional athletes or people who play elite sport, that you are invincible, that you just can't be, you know, there's no way I can be sick. I've played at this elite level, there's no way that this can happen to me. And then on the mental side of it, you're thinking, well, I got through all the stuff that I got through with the FAI, I got through all the stuff that I got through with my walking day and through my playing career. Nothing's gonna affect me. And then suddenly you realise, you look and you go, oh my God, I am now, okay, like the stuff I dealt with was, like, I had no clothes that would fit. So I went down to Dunstars, I bought 3 tracksuits in the medium and lived in them for 2 months. Like, they're only little things, but I just could not face going outside the door and seeing anybody seeing me in the condition I was in, because when you're you play at a certain level or whatever level of sport that you compete at, there's a perception of what people's perception of you is and what your perception of yourself is. And that's what we had to break down, that I'm not the same person that I was. I'm different. And I need to make sure that I look after myself in my head and my body, that I've changed. I'm not the footballer I was before. I'm vulnerable like everybody else is vulnerable to these diseases. And I need to get help. And as I said, without my wife pushing me to get the blood test, I don't know whether I would have got through, because any bit longer, I would have been out. Right up through me and probably too far, like stage 3 was stage 3 cancer I had. But if I had gone another 8 or 9 months, God knows where you would have been. So there's, as I said, yeah, there's a huge lesson to learn, and I've learned a lot about myself in the last 8 or 9 months, and I'm definitely stronger for it. I'm definitely, from my mind's point of view, I'm on antidepressant tablets at the moment, the sleep tablets and other bits and pieces to help me and assist me along the way. But I'm definitely stronger for it. And as I said, if what I've gone through and what I've spoken out about, I hope that helps other people in the same situation. And time is a healer in this stuff as well. Time is a healer. And you just have to try and get through. But you have to seek help. And you have to. The one thing I did was close myself away. That was the biggest mistake I made. I should have been out meeting people, talking to people through what I was going through. But again, like a lot of males and particularly sports people, you lock yourself away if you don't people see you.
We talk so often about trying to remove the stigma that's around mental health, and it's a really hard thing to do. But yet when somebody like you, Stephen, comes on the radio with me and just very casually almost mentions the fact that you're on antidepressants and sleeping tablets, that goes a long way to normalising dealing with mental health in a medical and professional way.
Yeah, and it's, from my end, again, when I went into the hospital, Marie, I had no doctor. I haven't been to a doctor in 20 years. I've never taken a headache tablet in 20 years. I don't take anything. I've never taken a tablet in my life. And I've gone from that now to having to be taking stomach tablets, to be taking antidepressants, to be taking sleeping tablets, which I'd never done before. But I need them. And I have to deal with the fact that I can't sleep at night without the sleeping tablet. And I was living, as I said, from sleeping tablet to sleeping tablet. And I was living for the hoping that the nights were going to get dark, or hoping that it was going to rain. Because I wanted no sunlight coming in. I wanted it to be dark. And these are the types of situations you find yourself in. I didn't want to get out of bed. I didn't want to do anything. I couldn't pick up the phone. As I said, I was very lucky to have good friends who some have gone through mental health issues. Alan Moore was one who drove. He was former Irish international player for Wigan. Working for Wigan now as a scout. And he drove over and stood in the garden and said, "I'm not coming out. Well, I'm not going until you come out with you," and demanded me to start talking about it. And that was a big turning point at the time, because that was the first people that I'd seen outside of my family. So that was a huge, and he knew what it had been like. He knew how difficult, from a mental health perspective, is how difficult that is to do, but you need to do it. And it was a huge moment, and them talking to me saying, "Look, you don't look too bad. You know, okay, yeah, you put the weight back on. You get your diet back, or you get your food intake back, it would be fine." But and then you talk about stuff that we've done when we were kids, and whether he was going to Manchester United and trials and played for Middlesbrough, and we could talk about his career and my one. And then that suddenly makes you feel a little bit better. You go back inside a little bit of a pep more in your step, and you go, "Oh, yeah, tomorrow then we'll do a little bit more and you know, go meet the lads again and go for a walk." And then I just found myself coming out with things then. But again, I'm not underestimating what everybody else is going through. Anybody who has the disease will tell you that the mental side of it is as much, if not worse, than the physical side of it.
It sounds like you had to get to know yourself all over again, that you didn't recognise the person that you would become because of the illness.
Yeah, I suppose when I looked in the mirror, I saw somebody looking back at me going, "Who is that?" Like, I didn't recognise myself. I didn't like myself being vulnerable. I wasn't used to being vulnerable. I was used to always being okay. My kids see their dad as somebody who played football, who represents professional footballers, who's who was always up and gone and out in his car and dropping the kids to training or taking or coach me, my son's team, taking training, all this. And then suddenly the dad's lying there and he can't move it. And that, even from my own point of view, for somebody who's been active for their whole life, to suddenly find yourself bedridden and suddenly look in the mirror and go, who is that bloke? That's not me. Look, I'm 6 foot two, 15 stone. I'm not 11 stone, 11 pounds, crunched over and can't move it. That's not me. And that took me a long time, a good few months, to get my head around that. And the digestion, I tried to eat with a problem, because like, the signals from my stomach to my brain weren't functioning because my stomach had been removed. So that took a huge amount of time for that to come back. And I had to train myself to eat again. I had to train myself. I had to put an app on the phone that would alert me every hour to eat something. It was gone days without eating because there was no signal coming. And when I got that back in and started to start putting a few pounds, my confidence started to grow a little bit more. And then with friends around me who are telling me, look, you're getting better. Just keep going. We'll keep talking. We'll keep coming up to the house. And that was just so important. And there's some great people, the likes of people at Shamrock Rovers, and particularly Bohemians as well, who were hugely helpful to me in the recovery and had been up to the house and had helped me out in so many ways. I can't thank them enough. I'm just very lucky to be involved in the sport where people actually care about each other. And battles I've had with people at clubs and at the FAI, but when it came down to it, so many people that had been in touch to help, I just can't thank them enough. And that's something that's why we're involved in sport, that it's not all about, you know, when you're being successful, but when you're down, it was great to see people there to help you. And I can't thank people enough, and especially people who've been in touch the last couple of days.
Yeah, we always talk as well about just how enjoyable it is to go out and play sport and to watch it. But the real value of sport, I think, is when times get tough and you need people to rally around you to help you. It's that sporting community that more often than not are the ones that step up.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more. And I suppose I underestimated probably how many people were there, because I suppose I played and I'm in an administrative role here now, so I would be dealing with all the clubs at the majority of times, and you get to know a huge amount of people, and it was probably a real eye-opener to me about how many people cared. I kept it to myself for so long, and what happened, Marie, was I was starting to go to games, and it was getting awkward then, because I was meeting people like Ollie Horgan or Martin Hussler, other guys, and chatting away to them, and then they'd hear laughter that I wasn't well, and say, you never told me that. So I just decided the weekend, it's time to put it out there. I'd also got a feeling from a few individual people that he wouldn't mind me coming out and talking about it to help others, and I just felt that it was at that time the right thing to do. And I said, yeah, I'm looking forward to getting back to work. I've been back to work the last couple of weeks, and I was over with Jack Bourne in Cyprus a couple of weeks ago, and from FIFA, so the World Players Union were heavily involved and that sort of thing. So I'm just delighted to be back working, and delighted that hopefully now over the next couple of weeks and months when I'm around the clubs that we can ensure that from a mental health perspective that we're ensuring that we're helping our own members, current band class, and our awards are coming up. One of the sponsors of the night will be Heading Again, which is a group who look after mental health. That's somebody that I'm working with at the moment. So we look forward to working with everybody over the next couple of weeks and months, and hopefully, as I said, from my own perspective, that I can get back to working and get back to some type of normality.
Well, it's great to hear you sounding so well, and we're getting a super reaction to your interview as well. So many people wishing you the best in your recovery, and I think here on the show we would all echo those views as well. Stephen McGuinness, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck with the recovery.
With Green Firm. Fuel your day with Green Firm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet. 100% natural and packed with flavour.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On with Marie Crowe. Now, Craig Breen has landed a full World Rally Championship campaign with Ford, and a little bit earlier, he caught up with our John Kenny.
Game on 2FM.
Craig, congratulations. Lifelong dream, I suppose. You had a couple of years at Citroën. You've done the third car duties at Hyundai, but now, lo and behold, a two-year deal with M Sport. Tell us how this came about.
Yeah, honestly, it's something that we've been working on the last couple of months. Obviously, I've had partial seasons in the World Championship for the last couple of years, and it's been nice, and I've enjoyed it with the time with Hyundai. But obviously, you know, myself and Paul are searching to be world champions. And you don't need to be a mathematician to figure out that you can't win world championship titles, you know, not doing all the seasons. So, we've been working on this, trying to make it happen for the last couple of months, and yeah, finally I've been able to make it happen with M Sport and Ford. So just, yeah, looking forward to getting everything started now.
It's a new era from World Rally Championship, isn't it, with the hybrid cars coming in. Just briefly explain to us what a hybrid car is and what's the difference between that and a World Rally car that you're currently competing in or competed in for Hyundai.
Yeah, obviously the sport is going into a new set of regulations for next year. It's going to be changing quite a lot. It's going to be obviously it's still with an internal combustion engine, so a normal standard petrol engine in the car. But we're going to have a battery pack and a motor that will work in tangent with the combustion engine, and will give you up to, I think, the equivalent of around 100 brake horsepower more at different times, depending on how much regeneration you've done during the stage. So every time you brake, you regenerate energy. And then you're given various times that you can boost along the stage. So this will be part of it. And as well as that, inside in the service park, the car will, from what I understand, run on pure electric power as well. So it's a start of the sport moving to a more greener, more greener face, let's say. I'm looking forward to it. It's a completely different car from what we'll have had. The regulations will be completely different to what we've had the last, basically since the sport has started. So it's going to be a whole new dawn.
You've tested it. How did you find it, the new Puma?
Yeah, it was really nice, I have to say. Obviously, the regulations are very different. The cars are drastically different from the predecessors. So obviously, you have to get used to how the hybrid system works, figuring out how the regeneration system works. And yeah, getting used to working with new people, new faces, completely new environment. But the car is good. Definitely has potential, and it's going to be an exciting year, an exciting 2 years even. So.
Will we see you in Ireland anytime soon?
Honestly, not so sure. This full World Championship program is going to take pretty much every ounce of myself and Paul and all the people involved in the program to make it happen. You know, we want to be world champions. It means that I have to dedicate absolutely everything and every part of my life, to try and make that happen. It's a very, very crucial part of my career and my life. So I wouldn't like to jeopardize any of it by doing stuff out of the program. Ultimately, I love doing the rallies back home as well. So you never know what might happen. But absolute full and first priority must go to this program.
And obviously, a word about Paul Nagel. He's been with Chris Meek and Citroen. He's been with you now for the last couple of years, a man you know well. He's rather like a caddy on a golf course. You need a good co-driver. And obviously delighted to have Paul with you in the next step for you for your career.
Yeah, no, obviously great. Great that Paul's on board again. Since we've sort of rejoined the last couple of seasons, it's been really great. I think we've really both been at the top of our careers these last couple of years, and things have been getting better and better. Having good wine, perhaps. But I'm really looking forward to getting started with it next year. Paul's just as motivated as I am, and I'm sure it's going to be a great time with everybody there. Just can't wait to get started.
Okay, well, congratulations, Craig. It's long overdue, and best of luck in the World Championship. We will be talking to you again, obviously, before the year is out. But best of luck with the testing, and congratulations once again to yourself and Paul.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Have your dinner ready in a flash with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet, available in selected stores nationwide.
2FM.
Now, the sports world was rocked over the last week or so with the revelations coming from the National Women's Soccer League. It centres on Paul Riley, one of the most decorated and well-respected coaches in the league. Last week, he was accused of coercing a player into having sex with him, along with verbal abuse and other inappropriate behaviour. Former players Sinead Farley and Manna Shim made the decision to share their stories, turning the spotlight on player welfare in the WSL. Let's hear from them.
When we turn now to Sinead Farley and Manna Shim, they are joining us exclusively. And with them for support is Alex Morgan, the former captain of the U.S. Women's National Team, who now plays for the Orlando Pride. Good morning to all of you. Manna, I just keep thinking about you. 1 week ago today was the day before this big story came out, before you came out publicly and told this story. You had no idea what would happen. And now as we sit here, Paul Riley has been fired. He's been suspended from coaching. The commissioner of the soccer league is out. How do you feel in this moment?
I'm feeling so many emotions, just overcome with gratitude at everyone who spoke it out and supported us. I feel very deeply sad and heartbroken about what happened. And it's bringing up a lot of feelings that, I was sitting with for years, but they were dormant. And yeah, so it's a mixture of things. I want more. I want more justice. I want better policies. I want players to be protected. And at the same time, I feel like we're on the right path. And I'm grateful for everyone who's reached out and supported us.
I want to bring Sinead into this conversation. Sinead, you sat with this secret for years and years and have just come forward to tell these stories. How are you feeling in this moment?
Yeah, I would say similarly to Mana, it is the whole spectrum of emotions, completely overwhelmed. The support and the validation by everyone globally has just been, it has blown me away.
Now, that's Sinead Farley and Mana Shim speaking a little bit earlier about the ordeal that they suffered at the hands of Paul Riley. Riley is now gone, as is the commissioner and the league's general counsel. Jeff Shepherd joins us on the line, our American sports correspondent, and Lisa Fallon, former Chelsea women's coach, now at Galway United, is also with us. Shep, to you first. Why did it take these women speaking out for change to happen, just given the fact that they already reported Riley's behaviour to the Thorns in 2015?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question I think everybody is asking, Marie, is, you know, if you're going to have systems in place that athletes, I mean, look, any age, any gender, I mean, anything, that they're supposed to be able to go to, you know, this route to get protection, to report something. And if those things are just disregarded and behavior is allowed to continue, what's even the point? You know, I mean, who are we kidding here? I mean, The big article that came out in The Athletic says they talked to more than a dozen people about this coach. So, I mean, there's no way that many women just had their head in the sands and weren't talking, and there wasn't clearly a pattern here and, you know, an MO that this coach had to with the tactics that he was using. I mean, it's just not possible to have this all over the country. And to just ignore it, I mean, I think that is part of the reason why we've seen, you know, the commissioner resign and another general manager in the league resign, because obviously people had to know and just nothing was done.
Lisa, four different coaches, all men, have been fired in just the last 4 months for off-field reasons. These include sexual misconduct, verbal abuse, toxic work environments and racist remarks. It's a frightening culture.
Yeah, it is. And I echo Mana's words there. I feel very sad as a female in football, and it is a heartbreaking story. And what's even worse is we know that there are more stories like it, and the courage that those women have had to come out and tell their stories with the dignity that they did. And I'm so pleased that they're finally getting the support that they should have gotten in the first place. And the courage it must have taken for them to do that is beyond belief. But it is so, so important that their voices are heard now and that action is taken, and that we make sure that every person in football across the world makes sure that wherever a culture like that exists or existed, that it's eradicated from the game, and it's eradicated from the game now and for once and for all, because that is totally, totally unacceptable.
And Lisa, it doesn't just stop with the USA already, since the allegations have come out from what is happening in the league over there. A former Australian women's footballer has come out and detailed some of the abuse that she suffered. And now the Venezuela national team have also raised some really, really frightening points about the way that they've been treated. They were sexually exploited and have really been suffering over there. I think this could only be the tip of the iceberg, really.
It's really been very harrowing reading, but I think it's important that we do and that we understand what happened, because it's only when we have a true understanding of what happened that we can make sure that things are put in place to make sure that this stuff never, ever, ever happens again, and that those players are protected and that they're given all the supports that they need, albeit late. I mean, to be a coach, and sport is one of the greatest outlets for people, and sometimes sport itself is a sanctity. It is a saving place for people, and it for people to go to sport, something that they're so, so passionate about and that they love, and for that to become an unsafe environment or an environment where they are bullied or coerced or any such type of behaviour is totally, totally unacceptable. And we have to listen to them. We have to listen to all the stories, as painful as that might be, as a society, as an industry, and as a community. We have to listen to those stories and make sure that what's needed to be done gets done, and that the protection is put in place, and that we change that culture, because it cannot continue.
The culture is one thing, and that is really disturbing in itself. But Shep, the fact that they weren't listened to, and the fact that some of these men had been reported in past positions like Riley, and they were still able to go and get other jobs, other big jobs, the fact that the league were covering up the way that these women were treated, the fact that they were just trying to keep these coaches careers intact, and they successfully did that until these two very brave women stood up. It would just make you worry about what else has happened, what else is happening. We've seen, you know, we've spoken about what the ordeal that the gymnasts in America went through as well. Do you think that women's sport, and we'll just look at America because that's where you are we going to be able to break this cycle now, this cycle of it's abuse of women, it's a culture of silence, of fear, of putting men in these positions where they're able to abuse women? Do you think that this is going to make change?
Well, first off, Marie, I mean, I think the parallel to what the gymnastics team has recently gone through, and if you listened to a lot of that testimony, as Lisa said earlier, I mean, it's just as difficult as this is to listen to all these stories. I mean, there are a lot of parallels. I mean, they were going to authority figures and telling them what was going on, and I think the FBI was even involved, and it just kept continuing. I mean, Larry Nassar continued to have a job, and some of the administration at Michigan State continued to have a job, and so finally, the voices got so loud they could no longer be ignored. There are things that happen with, in the heat of a game, or something might be said, and you would regret it. But I mean, the things that we're talking about here are, and especially in the instance of the gymnast, I mean, and they are illegal. Just immoral and all this. I mean, it's people making despicable, disgusting choices. I certainly do not want to paint every male that is coaching a women's team into the same brush, but the world has just changed. If you don't want to accept that, you're gonna have problems. I mean, the way things were done when my grandparents were playing sports, the world just doesn't function like that anymore. In a nice, upstanding society, you cannot treat people like this. And I don't know if it's discussions that have to be had, you wouldn't think that you would have to have discussions with coaches of professional soccer players on how they can and can't treat their players. But clearly, that sounds like something that needs to be had. And I don't know whether it's the Women's Soccer League, it's in the WNBA, it's in, softball leagues, it's just in sports in general. But apparently these discussions need to be reinforced by the governing bodies of these institutions to make sure that the messages are being delivered, because apparently some people cannot police themselves and cannot control how they act and the things they do and the things that they say, and that's really sad. I mean, first and foremost, it's just sad that a married man would do this, that any man would do this to his players, the people that he is supposed to be in charge of. I mean, Lisa can obviously talk about, when you're a coach, you are in a position of respect. I mean, the players look up to you. They look to you for guidance, and to just violate that so egregiously is beyond the pale.
And look, I guess when you do break it down, they were enabled as well. They were put into these positions, and they were a lot of the stuff was covered up. Now Riley has come out and said that he has denied all allegations, but they did speak to quite a number of women who verified the stories of Sinead Farrelly and Mana Shim. Look, Lisa, listening to them and their interview a little bit earlier is on as well, one thing that really stood out was the fact that this has had such a lasting effect on them, and it is going to have a long-lasting effect on them as well. Like, how important is it to put supports in place for these women and for the league to just start looking after them, to protect them and look after them?
I think it's really important, and I think, you know, whatever about the violation in the first place, for a player or for somebody who has suffered that to actually have the capacity or the courage to speak up in the first place is unimaginably difficult. It's almost as hard. And if the person that they speak to doesn't listen and doesn't give them the support and doesn't recognise what they have gone through, and the people that they trust to help them don't help them, that's just as bad. So we need to make sure that all the supports are in place for all of those players and anybody at all who has ever been affected in that way. But and we need to do that as a community and as a society and as an entire football industry. And more importantly, people need to speak up if they see it or they've seen it, like that. Call it out and correct it when you see it. Don't allow it to happen. Don't be a blind bystander to it. You know, everyone has a right to be safe in football. Everyone has a right to be safe in their sport. Everyone has a right to be safe in society. But this stuff is totally, totally unacceptable. And if there is a culture that exists there, it has to be eradicated. And those players have to be supported.
If anybody has been affected by any of the issues that we've raised here on this programme tonight, please do go to rte.ie/support. Jeff Shepherd, thank you so much for joining us and filling us in on the reaction over in the United States. Lisa Fallon, stay with me because I do want to talk about the Women's FAI Cup semi-finals.
Green Farm. Get back on track after summer with Green Farm's high protein cooked chicken breast fillet range. Available in selected stores nationwide.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. Now we are going to turn our attention to Camogie, because in 2021, St. Brendan's GAA club in Grange Gorman established a team which started competition only this year, and they started as they meant to go on with the county final win. And I'm delighted to say that I'm going to be chatting to two of their players. First up, I have Six Mile Bridge woman Kate Redden on the phone. Kate, tell me a little bit about, how are you? Good to talk to you after a very long time.
Yeah.
I was actually delighted. I looked up the picture of you earlier and I couldn't believe it was the same Kate Redden that I used to know, but you're obviously in Dublin now. How did you end up joining St. Brendan's? Tell me about the club.
So joined St. Brendan's actually when I came back from England, and I suppose when you join the GAA out foreign, like you're doing, like it just comes part of your family, and I was kind of just looking for a club that was a bit of crack and nothing too serious, and you know, it's been just something a bit different really than like other Dublin clubs that are around. So joined St. Brendan's, and we like won a few Dublin football county championships, and the girls just decided to set up the Camogie team this year and took off basically, and it's been great. It's been a fantastic year, and it's been great for the girls, and it's been great for St. Brendan's really.
One thing that really stands out about the club is that it is really multicultural and really inclusive as well, and it doesn't matter whether you have played hurling or camogie your whole life or whether you're just taking up the game, there's a place for you. And one of those people who did join is Olga Maya Katina from the Ukraine. Olga, welcome to the show. You're now a camogie player, a championship winning camogie player. How did you get involved in the sport, and how did you find taking up camogie, because it's not easy?
Hey there. Actually, it's a very interesting story. A lot to do with COVID, to be honest. Last year, it was all the lockdown, and they had to redefine of what I'm doing. Actually, one of the thoughts was, oh, maybe I'll try something very different for myself. And I joined St. Brendan's as the ladies' Gaelic football team. I still play Gaelic football as well.
A dual player, year. Olga.
Sorry?
A dual player.
Yes. Well, I try to. It's lots of crack, and girls are so amazing. That's just incredible. That's the part I love about it. this summer, Kate started a team, and it all started like, oh, let's come together, let's have some fun, let's enjoy it. And that all grew into winning the county championship. Who would even think about it?
Well, you know that there's teams out there that try for 30, 40, 50 years to win county titles. So the fact that you did it in your first year was absolutely phenomenal. But Kate, look, just listening to yourself and Olga, and also I'm a country person living up in Dublin, the GAA is so important when you do make that move, just to make friends, to find a community, just to, I guess, have a familiarity, a connection to maybe what is really important at home, which is just your sport and what you grew up playing. So to have that in Dublin must be really special.
Oh, 100%, yeah, because, like, in fairness, a lot of the girls, like, that were on the Camogie team this year had never even really played Camogie, and a few girls had, like, played when they were 12 and 13 and, you know, picked up Camogie, like, girls from Kinmare and Longford and, you know, so it's, like, from everywhere and anywhere, like, they're not really even hurling strongholds, if you know what I mean, but, like, it's been fantastic. Like, and we set it up really for people to make friends, and like we definitely have done that, and that was kind of the most important thing, like, for part of the club, you know. So, like, we enjoyed the celebrations, and I think we'll be celebrating for the rest of the year by the looks of things.
Yeah, and I think as well, guys, you're going to have some new players as well, because a club like St. Brendan sounds like the perfect club for people who do want to go and make friends and do a little bit of exercise. You know, pick up where they left off maybe 10 years ago, or just join something new, like both yourself and Kate and Olga did. So thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck in defending your county title. Now, Lisa Fallon is still with me here in studio. Lisa, we do have this small matter as well of the Women's FAI Cup semi-finals this weekend.
Yeah, two cracking games, Shells against Galway and Piemont against Wexford Youth. So it's going to be two brilliant games, Shells and Galway. Obviously, it's great to see the Galway women's team in a semi-final up against a really formidable Shelburne team. But since Stephen Lally's gone into Galway, you know, there's been a real resurgence, and Ruth Fahey working so hard in the background. You know, this is a great time for the Galway women's football club. So it'll be really, really good to see this game. I'm really interested in it. But obviously, when you look at the Women's National League, it's Piemont v Wexford. It's first against second. So it's going to be an absolute cracker. Wexford have so much FAI Cup pedigree, but as do Piemont. That's often been the final, actually. So listen, two cracking games to look forward to, and, you know, whoever wins the FAI Cup this year is going to really, really have to win it.
And just before we do finish up, Lisa, and we are nearly out of time, we've discussed a little bit as well over the last year or so about the FAI Cup, the women's game being played in Tala and not the Aviva Stadium. How do you feel about it?
There's arguments for and against. I love the fact that it's in the Aviva Stadium and players get to play in the showpiece stadium in this country. But on the other side of it, I like the fact that they can play in a Tala stadium that's become really synonymous with women's football here. And, you know, you could get a good full stadium and a good crowd and a noisy, like, you know, you get a full house in Tala stadium would echo in the Aviva stadium. So there's arguments for and against it.